Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and back with me once again to wrap up our four-part series is Nathan Gribble. Nathan, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing well, Nick. We saved arguably the best topic for last. It's certainly one of the most important topics when we discuss the game of basketball. You can't forget the fact that size does in fact matter when we talk about basketball, no pun intended. So glad we're talking about the centers to wrap up this fun series.
Yeah, so for those of you who missed the first three parts, this series is a 10-year draft retrospective on what we ended up grouping into four positional categories. So we started with guards, then we did wings, then a little bit of a break, and then last week we did forwards, and today we're doing centers. And given that this is a 10-year draft retrospective, there's one place that I think it's imperative to start, which is just how different the center position looks than it did 10 years ago. I'm just going to read off three names, and I think those three names are entirely telling of where we're at with big men in the modern NBA. 2015-2016 All-NBA teams. First All-NBA team center, DeAndre Jordan. Second team, DeMarcus Cousins. My pride and joy, DeMarcus Cousins. Third team, Andre Drummond. It's funny because Cousins is actually more like the sort of archetype that centers have evolved into than either of the other two guys. But suffice it to say that there was quite a bit of groundswell at the time that I'm sure, Nathan, you remember of, is this the death of the center? Is this just, you know, teams have gotten to the point where, you know, heliocentric offenses, big guards, wings handling the ball, etc. Is there any room for a 7-footer to be more than just a pick and roll dive man and rim protector? And Nikola Jokic says hi, and Joel Embiid also says hi, among, you know, Alperen Şengün, also Domantas Sabonis, also just a cavalcade of centers in the modern game who actually have higher overall offensive skill level in particular. It's something that even, again, given the names that I read off of the All-NBA teams 10 years ago, it seemed like the center position was about to be pigeonholed into you're just a defense-first piece who dunks down alley-oops on occasion. And, you know, again, now Nikola Jokic is the best player in the world, and there's just such an overall higher level of skill across the board. But I think given the contrast with the All-NBA team from 10 years ago, it's particularly noticeable at the center spot.
I mean, that's a common theme that's run through this podcast series that we've done, Nick, is just the crossover and overlap of skills between positions has just made a lot of this type of discourse so fascinating. And it's not that we don't have excellent big men who don't necessarily fit that new age of dribble pass shoot type of big, like all-star caliber bigs. You still have Rudy Gobert, you still have Jared Allen, both, even though Jared Allen's begun to shoot the ball a little bit more, and I think both have definitely gotten better as far as, you know, working in handoff games with another ball handler, they don't really fit that mold of, I'm going to break you down off the dribble, or I have this immaculate face-up game. They're primarily divers, play finishers, big men of that nature. But for the most part, a lot of the all-star caliber big men that we're looking at, really, you can even flex that out to this, a number of starters that I wouldn't necessarily grade out as all-stars as well at the position. That's really where a lot of it intersects, so the ability to handle the basketball and the ability to pass and make plays for others. You mentioned Jokic. You mentioned Embiid. I can throw Anthony Davis in that argument. We're watching what Victor Wembanyama's done in San Antonio, Bam Adebayo in Miami. Karl Anthony Towns has certainly become a guy who's become much more of a comfortable ball handler, actually breaking guys down, attacking a closeout because of how much of a shooting threat he is, getting to the basket, maybe even dumping the ball off for another. I'm actually really shocked that I thought where you were going to go, you always somehow find a way to start this with the Kings, and you technically did with DeMarcus Cousins.
Yeah, I was about to say, I got DeMarcus.
You didn't mention Domantas Sabonis.
Yeah, I did.
I didn't hear you mention Domantas Sabonis, but
you got to listen better, my man. Of course I mentioned Sabonis. What are you talking about?
But really, that's what we're talking about with these all-star caliber bigs. It's not just the ability to work a handoff action with another ball handler. It's their ability to maybe fake out of that dribble handoff and then be able to break somebody down, make the next play, really keep the ball moving, because otherwise, you know, you have a center out there in the dunker spot as a play finisher, but you're putting a lot more responsibility on the perimeter players to create. And listen, the NBA is full of plenty of these 6'7", 6'9", wing guys who can shut down perimeter players. And at some point, whether they're double teams or blitz, the ball's got to skip somewhere. And if you're skipping it to a big man who only knows how to go up and dunk the basketball, like you mentioned, like a DeAndre Jordan, like an Andre Drummond, you know, there's a much more different ways to actually game plan around that for defense to stop that, rather than, oh, you're skipping the ball to Nikola Jokic, who, all right, if more defenders want to crowd around him, he's going to find the open man. You want to crowd Domantas Sabonis, he's going to go find the open man. It's been something that Joel Embiid has certainly struggled with throughout his career, but on his best nights, he's been able to pass out of the double or certainly make a play off the bounce. So that's really been one of the most awesome evolutions in the game of basketball today, is that these bigs who are able to handle the ball and make plays. It's not like we haven't seen that, by the way, in older basketball. It just wasn't as pronounced, right? Especially with a lot of these big men scoring out of the post, you weren't seeing them face up from the free throw line and in constantly, at least not a lot of the more starter caliber. You had some of the all-stars, but not a lot of these starter calibers. You're seeing that a lot more. You weren't seeing them extend their range out the three-point line. You're seeing Jokic, Embiid, Wembanyama, Kristaps Porzingis, like these guys actually shooting threes, not just like taking a half of a three a game on average, but these guys actually being respectable shooters, willing to shoot at reasonable volume. So that to me has really been, when we're talking about this new age of big man and the evolution of why the position didn't quote unquote die, why if anything it's thriving now as much as it would have been in the 80s and 90s, is because big men have adapted with the rest of these positions, and the crossover of skill has certainly bled over into what they're doing.
I'm not sure. I don't think it was you that I mentioned this on a pod with, and if it was, I apologize for forgetting, but I have wondered pretty frequently, especially over the past year or so, about how different the NBA would have looked 10 years ago if Arvydas Sabonis had come over to the NBA in his prime rather than, you know, lingering overseas until he was so injured that he could barely move. And he still won Rookie of the Year at 31 years old because of how gifted he was. But, you know, just the sort of all around game, I think that's really the main sort of crux of the evolution. Is this is the most simple thing that has ever been said on this podcast, which is saying something, but you know, sometimes you do need to break it down to the most basic level. Being tall helps you play basketball, just right at the most basic level. And so, you know, we talked on the forward pod in particular about sort of the four out, one in kind of offense. And if you're quote unquote, we also talked about it in the guard section of how I love the Gary Payton II, Bruce Brown types that sort of invert this, but you know, the idea being if there's one player who's in the dunker spot, you know, there's, I think, a bit more room to be afforded to, you know, just in terms of more recent examples, the Derek Lively types, right? Of the sort of traditional rim running, rim protecting center is still valuable. And certainly when you get to a high enough level that you're doing it at, you know, Derek Lively II level, that's a very valuable archetype of player to have. But it's even better if, you know, you're 7 feet tall and you can, you know, dribble pass shoot like someone with the fluidity of Victor Wembanyama at 7'4". You know, that's nice skill set to have, right? I think it's really just sort of the bifurcation that has come about over the past 10 years of sort of increased skill level across the board that, you know, hey, if you can do the sort of traditional big man stuff, there's going to be a room for you in the NBA. You know, it might be as a backup, it might be as a starter, depending on how good you are at it, but there's always going to be a place for you if you can do those things at a high level. What's changed is, and you know, it's funny that Cousins was the second team All-NBA big man for the year that I brought up, but what's changed is that there's sort of more freedom being given to the DeMarcus Cousins types. And part of the freedom that Cousins had was because he was on dog shit Kings teams that, you know, didn't have anybody else to throw the ball to. But, you know, part of that as well is just that, you know, Sabonis went from his rookie year when he was basically just a spot up shooting four to, okay, actually good things happen when you have the ball in your hands, so we're going to let that happen more, right? It's kind of indicative of the evolution of centers that there's just sort of more of an increased willingness to say, you know what, you're 7 feet tall, but you're a really talented passer and you can, you know, make the kinds of passing reads that our 6 foot nothing point guard can't make. So we're going to let you make those plays more often rather than just sort of the pigeonholing that you could see by the other two centers that we mentioned on those all NBA teams.
No, 100%. I don't necessarily want to skate past what you started your comment with either about if you're a big man, you have to be able to do the traditional big man stuff. Like if you are a starting caliber center or better in the NBA, back when I did my statistical study across 2016 to 2023, just comparing, you know, guys at their respective positions, the average field goal percentage around the basket for those guys was 70%+. So we evaluate a number of big men, you know, at the college level who we think have a chance, but they're sometimes not as great of finishers around the rim. They certainly have questionable finishing marks. But a lot of that comes back to just, you mentioned it, the size and strength combo of this position. The average height of a center in the NBA, 6'11", the average weight is about 240 pounds. A lot of these guys that we're talking about who are excelling at the position are certainly bigger than 6'10", 6'11", and they weigh more than 240 pounds. A lot of them do weigh like 245, 250+ pounds. You know, there's some outliers, obviously Wemby, Chet, and Alex Saar are the outliers at the position, but you also mentioned that they have the coordination, the fluidity, the mobility that some of those other guys don't have, and that's what makes them special.
Just quickly, but to interrupt, they're all, you know, extremely young. We don't expect them to be as skinny as they are by the time they're 25.
100%. We've seen some other guys certainly maximize their physical gifts and certainly add on weight the correct way and be able to certainly maximize the best of their careers with that. But yeah, great point. But even so, like they are outliers for a reason, right? Guys who weigh that little generally have not dominated at the position through the course of NBA's history. And it's because when you're a center, we've talked about all the different positional responsibilities in these different podcasts, but when you're a center, your primary focus is to dominate the paint on both ends of the floor. You need to be able to finish in the paint, and you need to be able to protect the paint, whether that's guarding another big man on the post one-on-one, whether that's helping to protect the basket from different areas on the floor, and then on the offensive side, whether that's being a catch and lob guy or catch and quick pivot move and finish in the basket like that. Those are the types of things that a big man has to be able to do at a high level. And if you don't do them at a high level, you're probably not a starter like you were talking about, Nick. You're a back end of the bench guy, or maybe you're trying to find your way in another professional league and come back from overseas. That's what's really separating a lot of these guys first and foremost is, can you protect the rim at a high level? Can you finish at a high level? Are you a liability when it comes to rebounding the basketball? Are you turnover prone when you catch it? Somebody doubles you. If you can answer those questions, then you get into the fun stuff, which is, okay, you've proven your role on the floor. We know one of the two things that you can do for that position at a great level. Now you can experiment with what happens if we bring you out in a five-out offense. Can you stretch the floor? Are you not just a guy who's going to hand the ball off and roll to the basket? Can you maybe fake that handoff like I talked about earlier, take somebody off the dribble? Are you a hub out of the short roll? Are you a hub around the free throw line like that? That's when you can start to bring a lot of that experimentation in and really see these guys evolve from starters to all-stars. But you have to be able to do the basics first and foremost.
Yeah, it's something that we talked about on some of the previous episodes that I think is particularly pertinent here, of the idea that it's not as much about, you know, the sort of traditional positional designations as much as it is you need, you know, two guys who are great screeners. You need two guys who are great rim protectors. You need a really good rebounder and at least a couple of people who can help on the glass, right? And I think, you know, the sort of broader skill sets for seven-footers in the modern NBA means that there's a little bit more flexibility with these things. But the flip side of that is, there are certain big man things that are just easier to do if you're bigger. Like a Zach Edey screen is by definition going to be more difficult to get around than a Chris Paul screen. Just freaking look at them, right? It's not that complicated. Right. And, you know, I think part of the concept here is, you know, and I'll bring it back to Domantas Sabonis because you taunted me about this earlier, but, you know, the idea there being, okay, you're not a great rim protector. What else can you do? Oh, be the best rebounder in basketball? Perfect. You know, something that I think about with this a lot is the tandem that we saw between Jaren Jackson Jr. and Steven Adams. Steven Adams is someone who's excellent at something that I first sort of started picking up on when covering the Brook Lopez Nets teams. Of Brook Lopez was always an atrocious rebounder if you looked at his rebounding numbers, but Somehow, the Nets always seemed to be a much better rebounding team when he was on the floor. It was very weird how that happened. And Steven Adams, it was a similar principle of, wow, this guy's getting like 9 rebounds a game, but 5 of them are on the offensive glass. It's like, well, yeah, because he's boxing out 2 guys at once. He never gets the defensive rebound by intention, by design. And, you know, with Jaren Jackson Jr., it's like, okay, well, you know, Steven Adams isn't the most mobile. He sets absolutely crushing screens. He's, you know, impossible to push off the block, but, you know, he's not the most mobile sort of rim protecting, shot blocking type. Okay, well, Jaren Jackson Jr. is someone who's a poor rebounder, has always been a poor rebounder, but you pair him with someone that boxes out a ridiculously high level, sets incredible screens. And with Jaren Jackson Jr., his shooting is good enough that, okay, you know, we can pair him with a more quote unquote traditional center because Triple J can shoot, right? That pairing was fascinating to me because, again, it's the conceptual idea of, you know, look, maybe in an isolated manner, you don't want Steven Adams to be your only sort of interior defender. On the flip side, if Jaren Jackson Jr. is your center, you need a lot of rebounding help outside of that. That's the kind of thing that, you know, again, the idea is just we want to have, you know, 2 rebounders who can help each other and 2 guys who can protect the rim and help each other. It's not necessarily, oh, this guy is a traditional center, right? It's more just, can we fulfill the skill sets that we need to have out there on the court at any given time with whatever mix of big men we have in the room? And sometimes that doesn't look the way you expect it to, but the important part is that it's actually effective.
And I'm so glad, before we might move on to another topic, I'm so glad that you brought up the aspect of screening, which I totally should have when I was running through my little checklist of big man responsibilities. But having someone at the center position who is such an excellent screener really opens things up for your offense. And it's why, you know, Rudy Gobert has been hassled a lot for what he may or may not be in the playoffs. But one big reason why, you know, most NBA teams, if not all of them, would love to have Rudy Gobert on their roster, more or less, is because he's been such an excellent screen assist guy, right? He's able to play in that pick and roll offense and essentially screen off that guard and make life difficult, right? The one way to attack another team who has a guard who isn't a hellish defender who's fighting over everything or able to get over everything is you're essentially making that team choose between 2 difficult options, right? If you're hard screening a guard who can't fight over and they have to go underneath and you're opening up a 3-point shot or a pull-up jump shot for a really great shooter who's paired with that screening center, you know, obviously that's putting the defense in a bind for that reason. But if the defense's other option is to show that center who might not be as mobile, who might be better off playing more in a drop coverage, or they do go back in that drop coverage, you're able to give that point guard space to operate and either find the roll man if that center shows a little too much and he's not able to recover back. And then you're asking the defense to rotate over and maybe help off somebody else. And then you're finding an open shot that way. Or if you're essentially screening somebody hard at the top and the defense's answer is to play that drop coverage, and then you're a guard who thrives in the mid range, like think a la old school Chris Paul, like you're opening up that mid range jump shot to be open at any given time. So having a big man who can actually catch somebody on a screen and who isn't just looking to ghost all of them all the time and slip to the basket, that to me is a very huge offensive advantage. And it's why, you know, a lot of those Golden State Warriors teams were effective, not just with Draymond playing center for all the playmaking aspects that he provided, but they had big men like Andrew Bogut who would hard screen somebody into oblivion and open up an easy 3-point shot for Steph.
Screen. That's fine.
However you want to classify it, a salty Kings fan, that's how I want to classify it. Yes. That's fine. But either way, the value of that is something that we still see in today's NBA. I'm glad you mentioned Zach Edey. That's one of the things we talked about last draft cycle with Zach Edey was, you know, maybe the offensive style of his game in the sense of posting him up 20 times a night isn't necessarily going to be something that translate over to the NBA volume, but having him as the type of screener he is at 7'4", working with Ja Morant, who's one of the best pick and roll point guards we have in the entire game, it opens up a lot of things for that Memphis offense. And that Memphis offense is definitely better when he's able to share the floor with Ja and they can start humming, either spraying that ball out to shooters or letting Ja work his magic once he gets that step off that screen.
Well, it's also funny with Zach Edey in particular, because he has, let me just confirm that I'm right here. He has taken 21.5 times as many 3-pointers in his rookie year as he did his entire collegiate career, which, you know, that's funny to me because of all the people that you would think, okay, this is not someone who's going to go the I have to shoot to get on the floor route, he would have been pretty near the top of the list. And yet even for him, it's like, okay, well, we need to at least get to a point with you where defenses have to, you know, maybe not even think twice, but, you know, at least look out there when you're spaced out beyond the 3-point line.
No, I completely agree, but it's something, I mean, it's something that he worked on a lot at Purdue, at least in terms of being able to be respectable at the free throw line, because he was just getting hacked and fouled all the time. And he consistently developed and became a better shooter at the free throw line. And, you know, last draft cycle, you heard all the murmurings that NBA teams thought that he was going to be able to shoot. And then you get to summer league and you get in the training camp and you heard the Grizzlies players in interviews say, they better look out for Zach Edey because I think this boy's going to start to shoot it. And yeah, it's amazing when you can add that dimension and be able to bring that out of his game because he does those other big man things really well. Not to turn this into a rookie podcast, but like per minute, he's one of the more productive players we have in the NBA. He hits the glass hard on both ends. He is the type of shot blocker you would want him to be at his size. He screens really well. He is a threat to roll to the basket because he's a little more mobile than some people wanted to give him credit for. Obviously, he's a post-up magnet. Like, he does all of those things so well to the point where you can then afford the opportunities to get him involved and get him some of those touches to where he's able to, as you said, drastically increase his three-point volume from college because they, you know, Purdue needed him down low. Yeah. All the time. That's what they needed. They wanted him to either catch the ball and either score around the post on a hook shot or draw the foul, get to the line, and produce efficient offense that way. The Memphis Grizzlies are not necessarily reliant on post-ups. They have a lot of other ways that they can generate offense, and they've done it all season long. And when Zach Edey's been able to play and able to play consistent minutes, he's been a really nice little feather in their cap in terms of what they've been able to do in the Western Conference.
So let's now move on to the topic that you and I disagreed about the most in our pre-planning, which, you know, it's not violent disagreement, but, you know, something that I think we need to discuss at length because we had very different opinions on it. And that is managing draft capital for big men who are not lottery pick types. So, you know, in other words, I mean, this is, if I'm remembering the year correctly, this is right about the start of our 10-year window for this retrospective of when Nerlens Noel got a 5-year, $70 million contract extension, declined it, went on the open market, and never got more than a vet minimum again, essentially. And that's something that I'm curious about, of how important it is to, you know, sort of toe the line between, okay, for our second round pick, do we want to secure the rights to big man X, or are we better off playing in the undrafted free agent market? And I'm curious to hear your opinion on this, because again, this was one that we disagreed about quite a bit in pre-planning.
So for the record, I just want to say that primarily NBA teams have agreed with you in the sense of, when we look at guys who have actually went in the second round, you eliminate somebody like a Nikola Jokic from that equation. But
well, yeah,
but guys who have actually been picked 45 or later in the second round, there really aren't a lot of them. Matter of fact, most of the guys I've graded, players that have actually played the center position that I've graded out at some point this season, is about 92 of them. You look down the list of guys who I would have in like a bench tier to a back of bench tier, one of those three groupings, and the majority of them are undrafted big men. You can think of, you know, recent guys like Nfali Dante, who hasn't quite broken through to the NBA yet. He's still stuck in the G League. Colin Castleton hasn't quite been able to break through to the NBA yet. Famous Jay Huff, who's actually been able to sign a contract, but he went undrafted. Jesse Edwards, Trey Jemison, Dwap Reith had to ultimately come back over after playing overseas after he went undrafted. So by letter of the law, the NBA would technically agree with you. And I suppose if that's the type of big man that you're going to get and you don't have other options in front of you, I can see that argument. What I would say, though, is that if you're a team in need of good size and you want to try to find starter caliber size, I mentioned those 92 big men that I've graded out. You know, only one player in that group that's been drafted 45 or later, I actually have graded out as a starter, and that's Naz Reid. So it's not necessarily a path to find quality size of the 39 of 92 centers that I have graded out as fifth starters or better, right? So going up the ladder, 32 of the 39 were drafted in the first round. So what I would say is you can find bargain bin size. You can try plug and play size off of the undrafted free agent market. You can try and find plug and play size, you know, on vet minimums and maybe not use your draft capital on a big man at all. Try and go other routes as far as perimeter players are concerned. But if you're looking for quality starter caliber size, it's my opinion that you should try and draft those players sooner rather than later. And I think it's why, you know, when we talk about this draft class, I think you're going to start to see a little bit of a groundswell in that favor to some of these big men actually moving up the ranks, because I do think there are a number of quality big men who deserve top 45 grades. And I think those guys are going to push to be drafted in the first round or close enough to it. And it's my opinion that when we're approaching what types of players to use draft capital on, I want to try and go after guys at positions who I know I'm not going to be able to trade for easily. So that's why you've seen a lot of people talk about two-way wings and their value in the draft and why you should look to draft those guys sooner rather than later. Quality big men are not always available easily on the trade market. I mean, you had a guy, we can talk about the rescinded trade between the Lakers and the Hornets for better or worse, but a guy like Mark Williams, who, if you put some of the injury stuff aside, he's been productive early in his career, and he was a top prospect coming out of college, and he was going to go for Dalton Connect, who is a guy who I had a top 10 grade on coming out of college, and multiple first-round picks. You know, the guys like Nikola Vucevic weren't moved easily. So you had multiple bigs in Portland who weren't moved, like DeAndre Ayton, Robert Williams. Like, good size generally isn't easy to get in the trade market. It's not easy to sign on the free agent market, and same with two-way wings. So that's why, you know, I get where you're coming from in the sense of if you're completely biting the apple at the other end of the spectrum and that's you're only dealing with bargain bin players, yeah, there's probably a bunch of politics that go into letting those guys go undrafted and being able to choose their destination, all that fun stuff. I get that. But if you have a hole at center that you need to fill on your team and fill within your rotation, your top eight, top nine rotation, to me, you've got to prioritize taking those guys with a top 45 pick and drafting them sooner rather than later and not just clutching on your pearls with your draft capital.
I guess
different answer to your question, but I wanted to make sure that like I got that point across of how I value centers in relation to other positions in the draft.
No, it's important clarity. I mean, part of the reason that I wanted to bring up this topic in particular is just I don't have my board from last year in front of me, but I feel like it's very similar to what I have on this year's board, which is I have two centers in my top 10. I have five more in the range between 27 and 43. And then all the rest of my centers are essentially right in the low 60s of just off the sort of quote unquote draftable section of the board, but also I don't want to put them much lower than the 60s. And that's kind of how I'm thinking about the position of if you think you can get a starting caliber big man in the lottery, absolutely take him because, you know, every team can, well, not literally every team, but pretty much every team can use the kind of versatile size with skill kind of big men. Like, you know, two of the top archetypes, which, you know, we can sort of transition a bit into talking about some of the top centers in this particular draft class. But, you know, the two top guys I have on my center board, I don't think are particularly surprising in Derek Queen and Kaman Malalach. And they're extraordinarily different, right? But I think both of them in different ways check the boxes of what we've been talking about of sort of the bifurcation of centers. Of Malalach is, you know, very much a project. There is shooting potential there, but for the most part, you're drafting him because he's 7'2", 250, has good hands, throws down alley-oops, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe not as good of a shot blocker as you would like, but, you know, still pretty solid in that arena. And then with Derek Queen, you have someone who, exceptional passer for a big man, you know, someone who you can actually run the offense through at a high level already, rather than sort of the dream potential version of it with Malalach. And then from there, I have this massive gap between Malalach and my next center. And part of that is just, if I think you're going to be a starting center, you're pretty clearly a lottery caliber pick to me. If you're someone who has to be, you know, a third big man type or a backup center type, that's the kind of player where, and you know, there are a couple other players we'll get to, hopefully time permitting, we'll get to before we wrap up here. But the idea there of my board design, which again, off the top of my head is very similar to last year's, is okay, if you're not the center who can check enough boxes that I think you're a lottery pick, how valuable is it to secure your backup big man? And I think that's a question that I think it's more important than I did before the year started. And I think part of that is just my Kings bias of, wow, things make a lot more sense when Jonas Valanciunas is the backup as opposed to Alex Len. But, you know, I think the concept there holds of, if you're a really valuable center, you should go near the top of the draft because, you know, most basic cliche there is, you can't teach size, right? But if you're not a starting quality center, you know, as you mentioned, I think I'm starting to waver a bit on how important it is to get a third big man who's really good. But once you're talking about a fourth, fifth big man, back of the bench guy, that's where I think the roster churn element comes in of, as you well know, there are a lot of talented big men in the G League who, if you're churning the 14th, 15th spot on your roster, I think that might be a better route to go than investing draft capital. The flip side, again, is something that I'm softening on this year in particular, but you know, it's been a trend over the last couple of years of, I think the backup center is more important than people think it is. I think the third string center is not.
I would disagree on there being great size in the G League. I think most of the good size that you find is in the NBA. I think, listen, if that's the approach you want to take, you just want to churn and burn that last roster spot and try and take chances on guys who went undrafted or whatever, like, you can do that. That's fine. Are you necessarily solving your backup big problem, though, by admittedly churning and burning through guys who you don't have confidence can actually, you know, claim a top nine rotation spot for you? Like, is that how you solve your problem? Or do you solve your problem by taking someone who, even if you have two other bigs on the roster and you take a third big, you know, one of these other guys, I know we're going to talk about Malawach, you mentioned Queen, who's been good. We can talk about, you know, Danny Wolf, Thomas Sorberg, and I Broom, you know, even going into the second round, like Maxime Reynaud, like Tomislav Ivicic, who I also got to see in person this weekend, Ryan Kalkbrenner, who you talked about before the pod. Like, there's a lot of these guys, you know, as well as I do with big men, that, you know, health sometimes isn't exactly in their favor. There's a lot more that can go wrong with big men per se than some of the other guards and wings in the NBA. And just having a really good insurance policy at this point, given how important size has become in today's game, with a lot of these teams, you know, trotting out these jumbo lineups with two big men or like a flexible forward and another big man and maybe another small forward who can play the likes of a power forward position, like what the Dallas Mavericks are going to try to do with PJ Washington in some of these jumbo lineups when everyone comes back healthy. Like, when you're facing these teams that have size all over the place, it kind of becomes an arms race to where you also kind of need to structure your team and position yourself to be able to acquire that type of size. And if it's hard to sign that type of guy who can actually stick in the free agent market, or, you know, trade for somebody like that, and you have to give up way more capital than it is actually using that draft pick, I guess my question would be, is your team in a position to where you truly do not need to take another big man because you have three NBA caliber bigs who are like top eight, top nine rotation guys? Or if you don't, then that player you're drafting instead of that big man, like, better be really worth it. Like, they better be one of these two-way wings that we're talking about. They better be one of these flexible defensive minded forwards who can also shoot the basketball, because it's getting harder for me to be talked into taking like a combo guard or like a point guard who may not measure up to the level of like a top 10 caliber guy over, you know, one of these other positions of need where you know that NBA teams are always going to need quality big men, whether they're a starter or whether they're coming off the bench in a more immediate, like 15, 20, 25 minute a night role. That's why I think big men have actually pushed up my board a lot more than they used to. I used to value a lot of these guys who are primarily, you know, shot creators and guys who could generate offense first, because we kind of think about the NBA in multiple ways as an offense first league with all the threes that are shot nowadays. But we tend to forget that it's defense that wins championships. It's defense that first and foremost is the backbone identity of a lot of these teams that go on to win in the playoffs. And part of having a legitimate defense is not just having these guys who are these ultra valuable rim protectors like a Wemby or a Chet, but it's just having size all over the place to at least be able to deter drivers, bump guys off their spots, and just make life a little harder for those very, very talented perimeter players that we have in the NBA. So it sounds like we just have like a slight disagreement in terms of our draft philosophies. I think you and I are coming from pretty good ends of the spectrum. But for me, unless I'm that much sold on this potential wing prospect that I'm going to draft in like the 20 to 30 range, if I have a potential need on my team for size, I might take somebody like a Wolf or a Broom or somebody like that in the mid to late first round than one of these other perimeter positions. But that's just my opinion.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned top 45 earlier. And, you know, you just said mid to late first round, which is exactly where I have both Danny Wolf and Jani Broom. But, you know, with the top 45 thing, I'm sticking to top 45 in particular, because in my editor's notes article from earlier this cycle, I wrote about Ryan Kalkbrenner. And the conclusion that I came to is I'm not dropping this guy below 45 on my board again, because I don't think he's going to be much more than a backup center in the NBA, but he is historically gifted offensively as a big man. And so, like, you know, I put all the numbers in my piece. Maybe they've changed a bit now. He, of course, went on a cold streak immediately after the piece came out to invalidate everything I said. So fine. But, you know, the reason that I stake that claim of I'm not dropping him below 45 is, look, I think people, even in the draft space, but certainly outside the draft space, tend to overestimate how many picks actually make it to significant long-term NBA careers. Like, if you're talking about the 45th pick, the odds of that guy even making the NBA at all is like 50-50 of like this guy actually plays a single NBA game. With Ryan Kalkbrenner, again, I don't think he's more than a backup center, but 12 minutes a game for him as a drop big, who's, you know, a pretty good drop big, not that mobile, but that's, you know, fine. You can work with that in 12 minutes a game, right? And, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, right? Like, the difference between having a competent backup center in Jonas Valanciunas and the roster turn element that the Kings did employ over the last few years, you know, between Chimezie Metu, Nemish Keita, Alex Len, JaVale McGee, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just having that player for 10 minutes a game where it's like, okay, I can throw him out there. He will make our offense better. He will not hurt our defense very much. He is a great high caliber third big man. That kind of player, absolutely, I think is not only worth drafting, but important to draft. Again, it's more, I think, the distinction where I'm drawing a slightly thicker red line between a third big man and a fourth big man. But, you know, again, that's sort of the concept of, given how confident I am that Ryan Kalkbrenner can be a 10-minute a game player, I'm not going to drop him below 45 because I know that there are NBA teams that need that kind of player, and that it's worth it for them to use that draft capital, as opposed to, as you mentioned, like, boy, just, you know, crossing my fingers, hoping this guy works out. And this is something I've talked about with second round picks in the past, and how Jay Crowder really changed my evaluation of those kinds of players is, look, if you know someone is going to be a good NBA player, even if they only play, you know, 4 or 5 seasons, mostly as a backup, you know, maybe even a third string guy, that is better than the vast majority of players you're going to get with the 45th pick. So just take the guy.
100%. And listen, I don't have Creighton's on-off numbers in front of me. I do have Kalkbrenner's numbers in front of me. But if I were to guess, that Creighton team would not be where they are in the Big East without Ryan Kalkbrenner, because he is that impactful of a two-way player. Obviously, a lot of what he does starts first and foremost with his rim protection and his defense. But you look at him offensively, what was the biggest box that we wanted to check first and foremost offensively with a big man? Is, are you a high-level finisher around the basket? Kalkbrenner checks that box emphatically. He can certainly rebound on both ends of the floor. He's been a much more willing shooter, which is why his offensive rebounding numbers aren't as dominant as they were in his first few years at Creighton, because he's playing a lot more away from the basket, and that's also just a lot of the style of offense that team has shifted to since he was a sophomore in college. But capable rebounder on both sides of the floor, somebody who isn't necessarily the greatest playmaker, but somebody who you can work a handoff game with. And we talked about his rim protection. Like, there's a lot that Kalkbrenner brings to the table that you're not necessarily finding in a lot of other big men prospects. So Is he someone who's probably going to develop into like a 40% three-point shooter? I don't know the answer to that question. Is he going to be somebody who is dynamic off the dribble and develops this face-up game where he's taking other centers off the bounce or like-sized people? Like, I don't think so. But just because the pick may seem a little quote-unquote boring to some doesn't mean that an NBA team won't make it because they're getting a quality player, like you talked about, at a backup position of need that tends to be in need more often than not in the NBA. Like, how many teams can you honestly, we don't have to go through all the depth charts and rosters, we don't have that in front of us, but like, how many teams do you honestly think there are in the NBA that are supremely confident in the three big men that they roster? And it's not just like only one or two of them. Like, how many teams do you actually think are content and happy with their third big men that they have on the roster? Like, I don't know if that's a lot of teams.
Off the top of my head, it's Cleveland, it's Memphis, and yeah, that's...
Yeah, and oh, by the way, those are two pretty good teams in the NBA, aren't they?
Yeah, they're like, doing all right.
they're doing all right. And like you even talked about with your Kings, like having a backup big like Jonas Valanciunas compared to what the Kings have had, you know, in prior stints. You know, you and I always talked about we would have loved if they gave Nemias Keita like a little bit more of a runway or a path to minutes, but like having a legitimate capable backup behind Domantas Sabonis has probably been pretty awesome for you to watch, hasn't it? Like that, you need to find these guys, and the best avenue to find players and develop talent is through the draft. So that's why, listen, when you get past like the 45th pick, again, there's a lot of politics that go into the second round, and if you're ever curious about that, there's, you know, I'm sure there's a number of agents or people in that space that you can talk to maybe learn a little bit more about how that process actually works to understand that. But if you get past 45, I get the notion completely. But if you're drafting inside the top 45 and there's quality size on the board and you know that you can have a hole that might be a potential hole on your roster, like take a Ryan Kalkbrenner, take a chance on a Maxime Reyneau, because I would much rather take the chance and maybe miss on one of those guys than take an archetype that much more falls in line of what I feel I can find in the G League, which, Not to necessarily say that guards are bad and you shouldn't draft guards who are like below 6'4". Like, I'm not going to go crazy like that, but there are a lot of very talented scoring guards in the G League. I could probably go like 25, 30, 35 deep that teams could roster with that 15th spot and maybe churn and burn a little bit easier than maybe actually hitting on one of those churn and burns and bringing in a quality guy in the rotation that I can actually use a draft pick on to go find one of those big men. So that's kind of just how... It is an interesting conversation. I've loved that we've been able to have it. It's just a big part of how my personal philosophy has honestly changed from when I started doing a lot of the scouting and draft work back in 2011 to where I am now, like 14 years later.
Very, very quickly before we wrap up, because we have a hard time limit that we're about to reach. You mentioned in passing that you saw Tomislav Ivicic and Kaman Malovac over the weekend. So talk about them, because they're certainly two big men who will factor into this conversation about this draft class.
Well, unfortunately, Illinois didn't have that great of a game against Duke. That was a little bit of a romp, so I don't necessarily have a ton to be able to say about Ivicic. I saw a little bit of the shooting. I saw a little bit of the rebounding. The defense was certainly a little bit of a mixed bag for him. So, again, I've seen Ivicic look much better on tape in prior games than that Duke game, so I can't let one game completely spell me, and I don't want to talk too negatively about him because I do think he's a legitimately interesting top 45 caliber big man. I think where more of my positive thoughts would lie would be on the fact that I was very impressed with Malovac, and there's going to be a lot of criticism with him because he's not one of these traditional big men in the sense of, or I shouldn't say traditional, more modern age big men in the sense of, I'm going to handle the basketball, break somebody down, I have a face-up game, you know, I'm showing that I'm a lethal shooter right now. His shooting projection is much more theoretical than it is in practice. But again, very, very high level finisher, gifted offensive rebounder. You mentioned the hands. I don't always love... He's an interesting player when we talk about hands, Nick. Like, there's multiple aspects to bring up with big men when we talk about hands. There's obviously being able to catch the ball on the move. There's being able to catch the ball when they seal somebody on the post. I don't always love his hands in terms of when he's catching the ball, but his soft touch when he's putting back those offensive rebounds that he's able to do for those putbacks, like, some of that stuff, the angles of which he's able to just quickly like get the ball off of his fingertips and just get it to go through, like that kind of stuff speaks to me. And that's a role that he can play at the NBA level, especially a lot of these teams who are launching a lot of these threes, maybe getting these positions where, you know, misses are going very high. They're bouncing high up off the backboard. They're bouncing high off the top of the rim. Malawach is 7'2". He's long. He certainly can get high enough off 2 feet. He can go get those rebounds, and then that soft touch, he's able to get you those putbacks to make sure that there's points going on the board and you're not leaving possessions empty-handed. So that was a really nice aspect of his game that I saw offensively. And then on the defensive end, they bring him up at the level a lot. Like they have him show help a lot, and he's actually able to recover very well. Like Tomislav Ivicic wasn't playing those games. He was always trying to position himself around the basket for a post up, and I couldn't recall in that game one time where Malawach wasn't able to recover and get a body on Ivicic and then make his life difficult in the post. So having a guy who, you know, he's very much a drop big man. You can obviously show him in coverage. He's not a switchable big man. I don't want him guarding on the perimeter all the time, but to have someone at that size with his strength, who I think moves his feet a little bit better than I anticipated, who has the type of scoring package as a lob catcher, as an offensive rebound finisher, someone who I know can put points on the board in effective ways, who also has the potential down the line to possibly be able to stretch the floor for you from 3-point range. You put all of those things together, Nick, and to me, it would be very difficult to pass on Malawach too far down in the lottery. Like, I don't know where he's going to go on draft night. I don't know where he's going to settle on a lot of people's boards. I would have a top six grade on him at this point. To me, like, I would be uncomfortable letting him fall down too far, because I think his potential for as young as he is, just given everything we've talked about as a center, being able to do the center things well and focus on a lot of the other stuff later to raise your ceiling, he checks a lot of those doing the center things well boxes for me. And so I'd be very comfortable taking that player, kind of like you talked about. To me, someone who stands out as a starter, you know, top half of the lottery for sure.
This goes full circle on a lot of things that we've talked about, but, you know, Steven wrote about Malawach recently for No Ceilings NBA. Check it out, noceilingsnba.com. And one of the things that he brought up was that Malawach has only been playing basketball for 5 years, but a lot of the things that he does best are the things that you can't really teach, like the touch being as soft as it is, obviously the size being what it is, and not just the size, but the mobility at the size, right? There's a lot of, you know, again, especially with the shooting, it's like, okay, maybe he can learn, you know, the soft touch certainly portends well on that front, but that's a lot of, can he pick this up? A lot of the stuff, again, that you can't teach is what, you know, is what's sort of at a high level for him. And sometimes, you know, sometimes that can be a concerning thing with big men, but for Malawach, I think it's very positive in terms of the sort of outlook for him of, look, everything that you could ask him to do, it's sort of the baseline level of what we've been talking about with big men, right? Be big defensively, get rebounds, throw down alley-oops, all of the sort of basic big men stuff that, you know, 10 years ago was sort of, this is it for big men. He's got the baseline. And then the question is just how much further can he go beyond that?
You know who fits that same mold as we wrap up? Yves Missi. You know who's having a great rookie season? Yves Missi. You know who's probably kicking themselves for passing on him? Quite a number of NBA teams, and certainly one scout in me who had Missi way too low on his board after being higher on him for most of the cycle, dropping him because a lot of those questions, in the sense of, we see where the NBA game's at now, we see how much skill and process and speed and awareness is involved to actually succeed in the game today. If you don't have a lot of high level playing experience, where does that ultimately have you on the NBA totem pole? That was a big reason why I actually knocked him down my board. And you know what? He's making me and a lot of other people look foolish, because he looks like a decade plus starter in the NBA, everything permitting. And I would certainly feel the same way about Malawach. So don't let that lack of playing experience, that is certainly a strong data point, and it's something to certainly point out about him and some other players, but don't let that scare you if you do have firm belief in the things that he's shown he can do well on the basketball court.
That certainly makes two of us with Missi the same thing. All right, he is Nathan Gerbel. You can find him on Twitter at DraftDeeper, and you can, of course, find his written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. Always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dive specific portion of the podcast, especially now that we're at the end of this four-part show, feel free to reach out to me, either Blue Sky or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.